Papke versus Harbert et al. And for the appellants, we have Ronald Parsons and Scott Heidepreen and Jeff Groskos, attorneys from Sioux Falls. Mr. Parsons, I understand you'll be making the argument. And for Harbert and the other defendants, we have Mr. Reed Rasmussen, an attorney from Aberdeen. And Mr. Parsons, you may proceed, sir. You have 20 minutes.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court and counsel, I just want to make sure you don't want to settle the case. The facts in this case are heartbreaking, as in many cases. Adeline Papke was out watering her flowers and she tripped. And she was taken to the hospital and she was advised by her doctors that she needed two knee replacements. The surgery was performed incorrectly. Both knees almost immediately dislocated again and, according to the plaintiff's experts, caused an interruption of blood flow to her lower legs. No vascular examination was done, and Adeline's legs began to die from lack of blood. And as all of the classic signs of vascular insufficiency developed, including discoloration and the appearance of black, purplish, gangrenous sores on her feet, no action was taken regarding that problem. Adeline was discharged to a nursing home with gangrene in her legs, and by the time it was finally recognized, it was too late, and both of her legs were amputated above the knee in order to save her life. But although these facts provide a necessary context, this appeal is about clear legal error. In this case, a misleading and prejudicial jury instruction, as well as the admission of undisclosed surprise expert testimony on the issue of proximate cause, each independently denied Adeline Papke a fair trial, and that's why we're here asking for relief. Instruction number 16, which was given to the jury and which was objected to at trial vigorously by Ms. Papke, is what is known as an error in judgment instruction. And what that does is emphasize that physicians are not necessarily liable for what are termed errors in judgment. Now, this instruction has become, as we've explained in our brief, increasingly disfavored among courts and abandoned, because what it does is it ends up supplanting, confusing, and injecting subjectivity into the other proper jury instructions which establish the standard of care.
Is there any other kind of professional negligence where that kind of an instruction is used?
I have seen cases in where it is used in legal malpractice decisions. We believe that it would not be appropriate in either circumstance.
Those South Dakota cases where we've approved that kind of instruction for legal malpractice?
I don't believe so. I'm not aware of any cases in South Dakota.
What do you do with the case where you've got maybe, say it's cancer, and you've got five different treatment options, and unfortunately the option that's selected doesn't achieve the result desired? Is that a problem in those kinds of cases if we don't allow this error in judgment? Are we making the doctor a guarantor?
I don't think so. Of course, this court has approved the instruction that makes clear that a bad result in and of itself does not amount to negligence. And other courts that have discarded the error in judgment instruction and said it's improper and prejudicial, some of them have allowed instructions that say when a physician chooses between acceptable alternative courses of treatment, then doing so just because it ended up not being successful is not negligence.
So that wasn't this case, though. There was no argument in this case that there were two acceptable methods of treatment and the doctor chose one.
Not at all. Not at all.
This is a case, if I recall, where the doctor said he did make a mistake.
That's exactly right. The doctor, and the entire theme of the case was this was a blown call. This was an error in judgment. But don't call it negligence.
You're leading into that, but I wanted to ask a little more. How was this instruction or this language used by defense counsel in closing argument?
Well, it was used, first of all, in trial. And what typically happens, and a very good defense attorneys, as Mr. Rasmussen is, use the instruction when they believe it will be given with the plaintiff's expert witnesses, and they lay the groundwork by saying, with asking the plaintiff's experts, well, this was just an exercise of judgment. This was just the physician making a judgment call. This was just judgment being exercised. Maybe it was wrong judgment, but that's all it was. And so that lays the seeds for the instruction then, that is, if it is given, and then the closing argument. And here at the settling of the instructions, the defense counsel mentioned, you know, arguing for it, saying this was vital to our case. We need this instruction because, as every witness has testified, this was just a judgment call. When really, error in judgment, whether something is a judgment call or whether it's an error in judgment, has absolutely nothing to do with the liability determination in this case.
You know, when you look at the instruction, there's another sentence that follows this error in judgment language, and I want to just read it to you because I want to know if perhaps this second sentence doesn't ameliorate the problem, where it says, right after the error in judgment language, it says, the physician is negligent if the error in judgment or lack of success is due to a failure to perform any of the duties as defined in these instructions. Does that cure the prior sentence?
I don't think it does, and courts have held that it does not cure an initial statement that errors in judgments are not necessarily negligence, because the confusion remains. The effect of supplanting what is the true liability determination, which is whether the standard of care was violated, that remains. And what happens is you talked about closing argument. In closing argument, the theme, I would suggest, was this was just a judgment call. The comparison was made to failing to diagnose gangrene was like betting on the wrong football team in the Super Bowl. And defense counsel went on to say, you know, that unfortunately we know his judgment was wrong, but the instructions clearly say that an error in judgment does not necessarily amount to negligence. Doctors make judgment calls, so that's the key. That's what you have to determine. And so what courts have held who've examined these types of instructions and tossed them out and are increasingly getting rid of them have said that a juror is not able to separate those concepts. First of all, error in judgment is not even defined, and anything can be described as an exercise in judgment or an error in judgment. So when you allow the case to be about, to become dominated by the question of whether was there an error in judgment, you've totally shifted the focus away from what is the true liability determination. And in Magluhat, which is one of this court's cases, tossing out similar instructions, but that included a good faith language as well. You know, this court said that the issue on which a jury should be instructed is whether the doctor departed from the required standard of care, and that deviation is not conditioned on bad faith or the physician's state of mind. But of course, it's also not conditioned whatsoever at all on whether there was an error in judgment. Whatever the jury or each individual juror decides that that means.
Isn't that what the last sentence of the jury instruction says?
It attempts to portray that. And I would say the cases we've cited in our brief from other jurisdictions, the Durazio case from Pennsylvania and others, have held that that attempt to cure the error in the instruction is not effective. And jurors continue to be confused by this language. And that's why this language is not appropriate.
How, or would this even have any applicability in those cases that where the doctor is using an experimental type of a treatment? Because unfortunately, the patient probably doesn't have a whole lot of other options. Is that going to dropping the error in judgment? Is that going to subject these doctors to potential liability?
I don't think it will. I think, first of all, there's always waivers when you're talking about some sort. There's consent when you're talking about some sort of experimental treatment. But I've also seen jury instructions that address that type of situation as well. So I think dropping this instruction has no adverse effects. The jury is still completely instructed on what is the issue they're supposed to be deciding. But allowing the instruction causes this type of confusion and causes this type of prejudice that many, many Supreme Courts have held simply prevents a medical malpractice victim from getting a fair trial. The reality is that no one wants to hold physicians liable for their negligence. I have sympathy for physicians who are being subjected to a civil trial. But the law is that when negligence occurs, there's a remedy for people who are injured by it. And so when you have this sort of escape hatch or parachute to give to a jury, to say here is the reason you don't have to hold this good doctor, good person, responsible for the damages that were caused by his negligence, they latch on to that. And that's what courts have been acknowledging in case after case. And I would suggest that this court found essentially that same thing in the Schamburger decisions and the Magbuhat decisions. The language was tied to good faith error in judgment, and the decision focused on the fact that good faith has nothing to do with it. But the spirit of the decision was a recognition that the standard of care is what matters.
Didn't it really, though, move it from subjective good faith to an objective standard, error in judgment?
I think that was the attempt, is to remove subjectivity, but I think by allowing the error in judgment language, the subjectivity was retained, because then the court is instructing the jury that errors in judgment aren't negligence, necessarily. And so there's a subjective element in there, when what we really need is just to look at the objective standard. And there were 7-8 jury instructions on what is the standard of care and what the order of proof is. But when you follow that up then with the kind of excuse, well, but errors in judgment aren't necessarily negligence, that's a commentary from the court saying, here's a bit of subjectivity for you to consider. And that's what we believe the courts have determined.
You argue that there's a trend against the error in judgment instruction. Were these arguments and was this trend presented to the trial court prior to giving instructions?
Yes, this was, I believe, very comprehensively argued at the settlement of the instructions and in the new trial motions. This was what the trial ended up being about, the settling of the instructions. This was the issue at the settling of the instructions. I think that's safe to say.
I understand. We're certainly not bound by the Pattern Jury Instruction Committee. But, you know, they've looked at this since Schamburger and Magbuhat and revised the instruction, but did not remove the good faith or the error in judgment language.
I think that's unfortunate. I think that...
Why?
Because I think the...
I understand it may be unfortunate, but why? Why wasn't it removed?
I don't know. I wish I knew the answer to that. This is the only jurisdiction that I'm aware of where this type of instruction has not expired with the first judicial blow. In other words, there are different wordings that these instructions fall under. Sometimes it says good faith error in judgment, sometimes mere error in judgment. There are different incarnations, but as far as I'm aware, when a Supreme Court says this type of instruction just isn't appropriate, it doesn't reemerge in another fashion. Now, there may be cases, but I'm just not aware of them.
California, we all acknowledge that the California pattern jury instructions are used all around the country, and California has this very similar instruction that was approved decades ago, and I don't know if it's been challenged recently, but it still stands.
Some courts have upheld the instruction. I don't dispute that. I think that was upheld a long time ago.
Let me ask you this. What concerns me is the practice of medicine just a pure science, or is there an art to it? And isn't this language a recognition that it is partly science and partly art, and so that the jurors are told, you know, sometimes doctors have to make a judgment about how to treat a certain patient, and that their judgments aren't always going to be right. Isn't that the kind of play in the wheels that we need in justice in order to make sure that the jurors aren't told this is a pure science and it has to be handled mechanically?
I think the thrust that you're asserting is something that is laid out very carefully in the standard of care instructions, and that these type of commentary are not necessary from the court in what is supposed to be a neutral charge from the jury. The recognition in the standard of care instructions that you have to meet the standard of care as established by expert testimony, that's an objective standard. And the instruction that says a bad result is not necessarily negligence, this court has approved that, and that attempts to deal with some of those problems. But the defense counsel is the one who should be arguing the evidence and arguing these, you know, making a focus, saying this doesn't meet the standard of care. This instruction, I think, has the effect of being a defense counsel argument. And I think that's the problem that many courts have had with these types of instructions. And I believe it's very prejudicial in this case. In the defendant's brief, they suggest, and at settlement instructions, they suggest this was vital to our case. And then in their brief, they say, but giving it was harmless error. I think that's just inconsistent. Obviously, this had a very big effect on the trial and was I would suggest, the centerpiece, one of the centerpieces of the closing argument.
Is this a discretion? Is this abuse of discretion, or what is our standard? Because I'm assuming some trial courts will include it, some trial courts may not include it. So how do we deal with that?
That's one of the other problems, is you have inconsistent justice, because there are courts, we had a case just a few weeks ago where the court said, I'm not giving this instruction, I don't think it's proper at all. And so you have I think this court needs to step in and say, can these be given, or should they just not be given, and let's just rely on the standard of care. But I do think it's a question of law.
Is there any circumstance where this instruction would be appropriate, or is this just across the board problem?
This instruction is across the board inappropriate because it's a commentary on the evidence, and it supplants the standard of care. It's confusing, and it injects subjectivity, and it's an undefined standard. What is an error in judgment?
Well, what about cases where there is two acceptable means of treatment, you know, say, for example, chemotherapy or radiation, and the doctor has to choose between one or the other? I know several courts have said those kinds of situations do call for this kind of an instruction.
I think there's an instruction that says that's been approved by many courts, including, I think, the Hawaii Supreme Court that we cited in our brief, that case, that give the instruction just as you explained it. And as you explain it, it makes sense. But what you've just explained doesn't reflect what this jury instruction says. This instruction just says, well, if there's an error in judgment, that's not necessarily negligence. So what you've articulated is something that perhaps is appropriate to tell a jury. What's in this instruction does not reflect that, I would suggest. And that's what courts have found. I'd like to move to what I think is our other issue, which is the surprise expert testimony. I think that just as forcefully warrants a new trial in this case. The defendant's expert, Dr. Goetz, came to trial with an undisclosed expert opinion on the critical issue of proximate cause in this case. He said he came up with the opinion sometime in the month before trial, and he didn't tell anyone about it, not even his defense counsel, until the middle of the trial. And so there's obviously no bad faith in this case. This is a case where an expert comes with something that no one has ever known about before. And what happened in this case, Judge Myron, first of all, excluded the testimony and said, well, under the rules, that can't be admitted. And then he later changes his mind and said, well, I am going to allow it. I'll allow a deposition over the lunch hour, and then we'll admit this testimony. And I think first instincts are often the correct ones, and I think that's true in this case.
Did he also suggest a continuance?
He did. He did. He suggested that there may be a continuance. This is a case. We had 9 experts who were testifying.
2 minutes, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. We did not seek a continuance. What we did do is get to depose him over the noon hour. He had never, ever issued an opinion on the issue of causation prior to this. And now at trial he wants to say, well, I think it's 50% more likely that even if the gangrene had been recognized, that she would have lost her legs anyway in November. We deposed him and we said, well, what is your basis for this opinion? And he said, well, it's based on my experience and my review of the literature. And we said, well, what do you mean based on your experience? He said, well, the risk factor is high for surgeries. And we said, well, what literature are you referring to? He said, well, I forget the name of the author after I read it. And he says, I'm totally guessing, but I would think that there's somewhere between 70-80% chance that she would lose her legs anyway in November. We would suggest that not only was this undisclosed, it was unreliable because there's no basis for that. And the fact that we weren't allowed to test this opinion prior to trial, we weren't allowed to challenge it, investigate it, get the literature he claims he read, that prejudiced us. And so I would suggest that either of those grounds warrants a new trial in this case. And if there are no further questions, I'll reserve my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Parsons. Mr. Rasmussen, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. I obviously don't agree with the summary of the facts that Mr. Parsons set forth, and the facts from our standpoint were considerably different than he laid out. But as he indicated, I don't think that's the real issue that we're talking about here today. It goes, first of all, to the jury instruction, the error in judgment instruction.
Ken, before you get to that, just to follow up so I don't forget, was there other evidence in the record similar to this undisclosed testimony of that expert?
From
anyone about that she would have lost her leg anyway? Was he the only one that testified to that?
No. Our other expert testified to that. And his that opinion was brought forth by the plaintiff's counsel in cross-examining him. We didn't bring that issue up with our other expert, Dr. Burt. That was brought up by the plaintiff's counsel during the cross-examination of him. So there was other evidence in the record that if something different had been done on November 22, it would not have made any difference. She would have lost her legs anyway.
Was the use of this instruction or the language in it a significant portion of your defense of the defendants?
It was a portion. I think the plaintiffs overstate the significance of it. I didn't, in closing argument, I didn't put the instruction up on an overhead. I didn't read the instruction. I made one reference to the instruction in the final argument. But I don't think it was the linchpin of our defense by any means whatsoever.
But you did say, you did tell the jury, look, in hindsight, he made a mistake. And then you tell the jury, but an error in judgment is not negligence.
And
how is the jury going to ever sort that out?
Well, Your Honor, I think that was prompted by the argument made by the defense counsel. There's no question Dr. Harbert, with 20/20 hindsight, after all is said and done, testified that his diagnosis on November 22, which originally was that the sores were pressure sores from the casts, he acknowledged that based on what later happened that he was probably wrong, that Mrs. Papke had underlying peripheral vascular disease, which had been missed not only by Dr. Harbert but by Dr. Peets, her primary care physician, and every other doctor that had looked at her. And so he acknowledged a misdiagnosis. There's substantial authority, and we cite a number of cases in our brief, that a misdiagnosis in and of itself is not negligence. Yet at least three times in the plaintiff's closing argument, counsel stated that basically the doctor admitted there's a misdiagnosis. That means there's really no issue about liability. It was almost as if he had admitted liability. I think we needed to, at that point in time, emphasize that just because he had acknowledged a misdiagnosis does not necessarily establish negligence, and that, therefore, an error in judgment is not always negligence. And that was the point that we were making.
So you say always negligence. If I recall your argument, you said it wasn't negligence.
Well, I can't remember the exact words I used, but the instruction clearly, as Justice Conyngham pointed out in the second sentence, it says if the error in judgment or lack of success is due to a failure to perform any of the duties as defined in the instructions, then it is negligence. And I think
did plaintiff's counsel then argue that last sentence?
I don't recall what if plaintiff's counsel did argue the last sentence. I suspect that he did, but I can't remember for sure, Your Honor. But I did want to point out, Justice Conyngham, you asked if this was a case where there were treatment options, and plaintiff's counsel said that it was not, but that's not correct. There are at least two separate instances in this case with issues where there clearly were treatment options, and the doctor chose one of the options. The first has to do with the original surgery itself. There was an issue raised regarding the stabilizing the knee. And the testimony was clear by all the experts, both plaintiffs and defense experts, that there's two ways to do it. You can keep the posterior collateral ligament in to stabilize the knee and do whatever else you have to do, or you sacrifice the PCL and put in a plastic prosthesis device. That's a clear choice. The testimony was that 50% of orthopedic surgeons use the plastic device, 50% do not.
But was that the issue? I mean, the cases that use that kind of an instruction spell out for the jury, you know, if a doctor does have two acceptable choices. But as I understand it, it was the dealing with these spots on her ankles, that was the issue here that we're talking about. Did he have two acceptable options in dealing with those spots? Was there testimony about that?
Well, yes, there is. But I just want to make the other issue. One of their experts did say it was negligent for them not to use the plastic
right.
device. So that was an issue. But yes, but when and the other time where there was a choice was when the sores were noted on the legs. The testimony from our experts were that at that point in time, Dr. Harbert basically had four choices. He could do nothing and just continue to observe the legs and see what developed. He could reduce the dislocations and then watch her to see how things went. He could reduce the dislocations and then immediately send her somewhere else, or he could just recast the legs and send her off to another facility. So he had four choices at that point in time, all of which had pros and cons, and our expert testimony was that he made a reasonable choice, which was there was no question these knees, the dislocations had to be taken care of. Whether that would be done by him or someone else was a choice that had to be made, and he made the choice to proceed ahead and repair the dislocations himself and then observe the legs. And he observed them and thought things were getting better, as did other physicians who were following her in the hospital. Unfortunately, later on, things went downhill, and we wound up with the tragic result that we have. But there were choices that he had to make with regard to what to do concerning the treatment, his treatment options at that point in time.
There wasn't a choice, though, about the diagnosis of the vascular disease. I mean, that was a question of you either caught it or you didn't catch it.
That's correct. And he acknowledged that. Again, with hindsight, but that's not unusual. I mean, there are certainly medicine, as indicated earlier, is not an exact science, and that's what makes medical malpractice cases or legal malpractice cases so much different than a car accident case, for instance. There are various choices a doctor has to make, and a multitude of diagnoses that can be made under certain circumstances, and sometimes. The diagnosis is wrong, but that does not necessarily mean there's negligence. And the jury has to look at all the other factors and consider the expert testimony, which obviously was done in this case, and the jury determined that in this case that misdiagnosis was not a negligent misdiagnosis. And that's the key. A misdiagnosis itself isn't negligent. You're only liable for a negligent misdiagnosis, which must be established by the expert testimony.
Doesn't the standard of care argument cover all that? Why do you need this instruction?
Well, I don't know that the standard of care argument necessarily covers all that. I don't know that the general instructions cover the fact that the plaintiffs were arguing in this case that misdiagnosis is negligent. And I think this instruction was appropriate for that reason, as well as the fact that there were choices that the doctor had to make as far as the treatment that was going to be rendered in this case. I don't think this instruction is nearly as confusing as the plaintiff contends. They seem to say that the jury would be confused and it would make the jury think that there are certain negligent acts for which a physician isn't liable. But that's not what this instruction says. It simply says that there are some errors in judgment that don't rise to negligence. And that's, I don't think anybody's saying that that's not a correct statement of the law. Their argument just seems to be that it's confusing. And it has, this instruction has been addressed by courts, a number of courts, and it's not a uniform. Certainly there are courts that have thrown it out, yet Mr. Parsons mentioned that he wasn't aware of any court that has modified the instruction. That's not true. In our brief, we cite a case in Washington where they use honest mistake in judgment or honest error in judgment, something like that, and the court said, henceforth, you should take out the word honest. And that's apparently what the law is in Washington at this point in time. And that's consistent with what...
That brings up a point, you know, you got to look at this from the perspective of the jury. They're not trained in the law, and they're being told that an error, basically, is not actionable. It's not negligence. The word error, when you combine that with judgment, how are they to determine that if you made an error, you're not responsible?
But that's not what they're being told. They're saying that an error is not necessarily negligent, but then in the very next sentence they're told that it is if the physician fails to perform the duties as set forth in the rest of the instructions. So they're not being told that an error is not make one liable. They're just saying that it doesn't always. And I think that's clearly correct law. And certainly in this court's prior decisions in Magbuhat and Schamberger, the focus of those decisions was on in Schamberger, the good faith language, and in Magbuhat, the bona fide language. There was no indication in those decisions that the court was saying that the error in judgment language itself was inappropriate. And admittedly in dicta, but in the Venner, Jorgensen versus Venner case, the court clearly said that an error in judgment isn't always negligent. And so
why does medical malpractice get this special instruction, whereas no other type of professional malpractice in South Dakota gets this kind of an explanation?
Well, I agree with Mr. Parsons. I don't think this court has addressed it in the context of a legal malpractice case, but I certainly would think it would be an appropriate instruction.
It's not in the pattern jury instructions. The only pattern jury instruction that includes this language is the medical malpractice one, isn't it?
I agree, but we don't have. We have some instructions for legal malpractice specifically related.
My understanding is that most states don't make a distinction between medical, legal, accountancy. Why does medicine get this special additional instruction?
Well, I guess I would disagree with you that most states don't make a distinction. I think there clearly is a distinction. We, in our pattern jury instructions, and I think this is the case.
All right, so why? I mean, why does medicine get it whereas other professionals don't?
Because I think medicine is not an exact science. And I think legal malpractice, whether this specific instruction would be in there, but there are special instructions for legal malpractice. Medicine is, as I said, different than a car accident case, for instance. There are many choices to be made. There are many diagnoses to be made. It is, to a certain extent, an art. And that's why I think virtually every state has their general negligence instructions, and then they have their professional malpractice instructions. They're two different things. And clearly, the courts for years have made a distinction between the normal negligence case and one involving doctors or lawyers or some other professionals. And I think that's totally appropriate. I guess based upon the rulings this court has previously made in Magpot, Schamberger, and the language in the Jorgensen versus Venner case, the court has certainly indicated that the error in judgment instruction is appropriate. Obviously, the pattern jury instruction committee, after Magbuhat and Schamberger, revised the instruction and left in the error in judgment language. But if this court feels that the instruction should no longer be given, I guess the bench and the bar should be informed of that. And I certainly don't believe that it should result in a reversal of the decision in this case and a remand for a new trial. In one of the cases cited in the plaintiff's reply brief, it's from the Pleasants versus Alliance Corporation from the West Virginia Supreme Court. That was a case involving mistake of judgment language, in which West Virginia determined that language should no longer be given. But in so doing, the West Virginia Supreme Court stated, other appellate courts have similarly concluded that a new trial is not required following the giving of a mistake of judgment instruction, provided the remainder of the charge correctly stated the standard for proving negligence. That's clearly what situation we have in this case. There's no argument that the remainder of the instructions were in any way inappropriate. And so if this court would decide that this instruction should no longer be given, I would urge it to, at a minimum, simply make such a determination and not remand this case for a new trial.
How do we know, though, whether the jury relied on the Aaron judgment language or relied on the other language? As the West Virginia court pointed out, the other language was adequate.
Well, I guess we don't know, and I don't suppose the West Virginia court did either. All they're saying is that, I guess the way they looked at it, they did not see it as that significant. If all the other language was correct, that the mere fact that the court instructed on mistake of judgment wasn't enough to cause a new trial. I want to move on. If there are no more questions on error in judgment, I'll talk about the other issue. I'm not going to spend a lot of time arguing about whether the disclosure was inappropriate in light of what I believe were problems with the disclosure of the plaintiff's expert. Judge Myron determined that some sanction was appropriate and made a determination that he would deal with that situation, and I think appropriately did so. He gave the plaintiffs the opportunity to depose Dr. Goetz over the noon hour, and I think that distinguishes this case from this court's recent decision in the Kaiser versus University Physicians case, which also had to do with the late disclosure, which isn't cited in anybody's brief because that case was decided after the briefs were submitted in this case. But the judge looked at the issue, considered all the equities, and made an appropriate, what he believed to be an appropriate remedy for the situation, and I think he was that decision should be affirmed.
Isn't this really, though, this is, particularly with medical malpractice, so much of the trial involves discovery and knowing what the other expert is going to say. And you spend months and maybe years preparing for a case like this. And then to have something like this come up at the very last minute, isn't it abuse of discretion to allow that in without the other side? I mean, this works both ways. You wouldn't want it to happen one way or either side. I mean, you've both prepared your case, you're there to try the case, and all of a sudden you've got a brand new expert opinion that you've not been able to deal with. And taking a deposition in noon hour seems to me, in the middle of a trial, not a very good way to try a case. Why isn't this abuse of discretion? Well, I mean, if the shoe were on the other foot, you'd be here screaming about it.
I would never scream. I understand, and you know, these things have happened. It's happened to me. It's happened to all of us that try these cases, and it is unfortunate. And sometimes your communication with your experts isn't as good as you probably would like. But I don't believe it's abuse of discretion. I think Judge Myron considered all the equities involved in the situation, and obviously gave it considerable thought. His initial reaction was to exclude the evidence, and then after reviewing the Schrader versus Jarks decision and thinking about it further, he fashioned another remedy. But it's important that, you know, he allowed the deposition to be taken. He did offer a continuance, and it, you know, at the end of everything, he asked the plaintiff's counsel, "Is there anything else that you want? Thank you, Your Honor. Want of me?" And there wasn't. And I think he appropriately dealt with the situation. As far as the Daubert issue is concerned, the court has wide discretion. The trial court has wide discretion, and I believe the evidence.
Was there really a Daubert hearing on this?
Well, I think the deposition of Dr. Goetz was considered by the court as the Daubert hearing, and I think that was appropriate.
What about the fact, though, that the his opinion was based on medical literature?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
The expert's opinion was based on medical literature, and the plaintiff's counsel was not able to, you know, go out and see if that literature actually supports what the doctor claimed he was basing his opinion on.
I think, as Judge Myron ruled, that issue went to the weight of his testimony rather than its admissibility, and the court appropriately ruled in that regard. The other thing that's important to keep in mind with regard to this issue, that issue only goes to causation. Doesn't go to negligence. Obviously, if the jury determined that there was no negligence, the causation issue meant nothing. And we don't know how the jury ruled because of the way the verdict form was worded. So again, if there was error, I believe it was harmless error. And again.
But if we approve this, wouldn't this be a distinct watering down of Kaiser versus University Physicians, which I know the trial court didn't have the benefit of because it came out, I think, during trial or after trial?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I think there are distinctions between the two cases. In Kaiser, I'm not sure the judge did anything to address the situation, just let the evidence in. Here, an extra deposition was allowed. A continuance was clearly offered. Beyond that, there was other testimony from another expert in the record, which basically said the same thing.
Your time has expired, Mr. Parsons.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Parsons, you have 10 minutes, sir.
On the error in judgment instruction, in the settlement of the instructions, the defense counsel specifically said this theory is vital to our case. Each witness has testified that this was just a judgment call, and we need this instruction in order to prove our case, is essentially what it was. So,
but he also said before that that it was a rebuttal to your allegations that this was an admission of error liability case ended.
That was at the settlement instructions, what I was just talking about. In closing argument, the argument was not related at all to whether a spacer was used in initial surgery. It was trying to justify the failure to misdiagnose gangrene. That's what the error in judgment reference entailed, and that's where it was brought up. And so that's the context in which the jury heard it. In order to argue the case, what we believe should have happened is that defense counsel should have argued that it doesn't rise to the level of a violation of the standard of care. That's the liability determination, and that's what the jury needs to be deciding, not whether something is or isn't an error in judgment. And so we would respectfully suggest that that is prejudicial in this case. In Jorgensen, this court said in pure dicta that an error in judgment will not result in negligence, or an error in judgment is not negligence. And that, I think, really typifies the confusion here, because an error in judgment obviously can be negligence. And yet there's a decision of this court which says an error in judgment is not negligence. And so I think that crystallizes the confusion. Lawyers get confused by this language, and if lawyers get confused by this language, juries are helpless. On the issue of the disclosed testimony, first of all, with regard to our expert's disclosure, our expert, at least 2 months prior to trial, disclosed an opinion on the issue of proximate cause, and that is the opinion that was given at trial. Now, there was, in response to a specific question, it was refined with the addition of a date, November 22nd, and so that is something that was not part of the disclosure. But the disclosure on proximate cause was made, and the defense had every opportunity to ask whatever questions that it wanted to of the expert and prepare for trial accordingly. And there, of course, was no objection to that at trial, and because it was not improper.
But was there some other testimony from either side that, you know where I'm going, so I'll
yes.
finish my question.
Yes.
Go ahead.
After the door had been opened, after Judge Myron let this in, we did attempt to address that testimony with another expert. And so I think we were left with no choice after the door had been opened to try to address with what had been let in the door. And so that's what happened. It was not raised independently. And there was no other opinion disclosed from any other expert on the defense's side related to that issue.
You're saying your evidence on this cause issue, or that the legs would have been lost anyway, came after the doctor's opinion? From the defense?
No, we've disclosed that in a deposition. We gave that opinion 2 months prior to trial. Was that your question?
Was it told to the jury before?
Yes, yes. Our opinion was expressed in our expert's direct examination.
And your own expert said she was going to lose her legs anyway?
No. Our expert says the legs would have been saved.
Okay.
Yes, right. I apologize. Our expert said quite clearly the legs would have been saved, and explained why.
But there weren't two defense witnesses who both said that she would have lost her legs anyway.
One, yeah, a second one did in response to a question from us after the door had been opened on the initial admission of testimony regarding Dr. Goetz. So it did come up again later, but we were attempting to deal with what had been let into the trial. Regarding Kaiser, I think Kaiser, in effect, or this is much worse than Kaiser, in effect, because in Kaiser what we had was a disclosed opinion that was bolstered by undisclosed documentary and supportive evidence. And here what we have is an undisclosed opinion that is bolstered by nothing, essentially, because we weren't able to conduct any discovery as to what the basis for this opinion was prior to trial, or obtain any of the literature that he was allegedly relying on. So I think this case is much worse than Kaiser, and not to reverse here, I think, would dilute Kaiser substantially.
What about the continuance, though? You were offered a continuance.
We were offered a continuance. We did not take the continuance. I can't walk away from what happened at that point. In Kaiser, the same thing happened, or actually a continuance was not requested, and this court nonetheless found that there was prejudicial error because you're not required to scuttle a trial, I would suggest, on the basis of one evidentiary ruling. But it's true. I don't walk away from that. If I could, and I'm not sure, Mr. Chief Justice, could I address the medical bills issue? It was not okay.
You're in rebuttal. He can't get up and say anything about it. So
I understand.
You'll be able to stand on your brief.
Thank you. With that, I respectfully ask that you reverse and grant a new trial.
Thank you, Mr. Parsons. The court will be in recess for 10 minutes.